chapter 7. The Rambam writes, the good which is hidden for the tzaddikim, for the righteous, is light in the world to come. And this is light that has no depth with it. And it is a good that has no evil with it. Now, you need to know that in Jewish literature, the phrase Olam Haba is used in three different ways. If you're not aware of this, you can be very confused when you read from one sefer to another. Sometimes, even in the same author, the phrase will be used in different ways. Sometimes, Olam Haba means what happens to the soul after death. The body dies, and the soul is in a position of being waiting for either the incarnation or resurrection. Sometimes that's what's called Olam Haba. Sometimes Olam Haba means the time of the Messiah, Mashiach, with Tchiyat HaMetim, with resurrection in this world. And sometimes Olam Haba means at the ultimate end, after Mashiach, after Tchiyat HaMetim, and after the world is destroyed and remade, after all of that, go into a condition that lasts forever. So you have to be very careful when you see the word Olam Haba. The first thing to ask is, what is the author referring to? Now the Rambam tells us, when he says Olam Haba, he means stage 3. The very end, after everything else has happened, condition which goes on forever. The reward of the righteous is that they merit this beauty and this good. The punishment of the wicked is that they don't merit this life, but they are cut off and die. So for the Rambam, the ultimate end is that humanity is divided into two groups. The righteous get this Olam Haba with everlasting life, and the wicked are simply cut off, and they cease to exist. They are annihilated. He's cut off like an animal. When the Torah talks about Kares being cut off, that's what it means. The soul is cut off. That soul which left the body in this world does not receive light in the world to come. It's cut off. I'll go back and comment on these things. Let's get a little more information. The world to come has no body, no bodily form, just souls. The souls of the righteous, like angels. People who have no bodies. Angels are purely spiritual beings. The soul is a purely spiritual thing. And in Olam Haba, there's no body. So people are represented by their souls without any body or any bodily form. And since there's no bodily form, there are no bodily activities. There's no eating, no drinking, nothing which the body needs. And nothing will happen to a person that happens to bodies. There's no bodily posture, like sitting, standing, sleeping, death, sadness, joking, and such things. And he says, the Talmud tells us, in the world to come, there's no eating, no drinking, no sexual relations. Rather, the tzaddikim are sitting
Now, this phrase is going to make a lot of
Batroseihem, Piroseihem. Their crowns,
it's taken over in modern Hebrew, but people don't appreciate what it means. Ekata, what do you mean? Atroseihem. Mapirush.
Should be all.
Correct. Kakomin. Lakuta Nipo. But Mapirush.
It says their crowns are in their heads. Birashehem. Not Al-Rashehem, but Birashehem. Their crowns are in their heads.
So now the Rambam comments. You see from this quote that there's no body, and there's no drinking, there's eating or drinking.
And therefore, when the quote says that the tzaddikim are sitting, it doesn't mean literally sitting, because there's no body. So how can they be sitting? It means that they're existing there.
Sitting means without any effort, without any strength. And when they said their crowns are in their heads, it means their crowns are their knowledge, their understanding.
That because of that knowledge and understanding, they merited the world to come. And that's the crown.
Now, he then goes on to say, he's been talking about nefesh. And the Rambam's position is that the word nefesh means the eternal soul, the soul that lasts forever. Neshama, he says, does not mean that. It's the opposite of what you've probably heard, because you don't know what the Rambam has written.
Neshama, he says, is related to nishima. Nishima means
breath. Even animals breathe. So says the Rambam, Nishama means just that which is physical, the ability to live as a physical body.
And of course, that's lost, just like animals are lost.
What left for the tzaddikim is the nefesh. Now I want you to know that what the Rambam writes here is very controversial. Maybe that's too weak. Maybe it's so controversial that a consensus has formed against it. The view of the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, which the Rambam did not have, is that the guf, the body, does go to Olam Habo in a certain sense. It is not kabbalah. I want to explain to you a little bit what the Kabbalah says about these matters, and then I want to offer you a speculation that maybe the Rambam and the Kabbalah are not so far apart as they seem. Because of something that the Rambam wrote elsewhere, not here particularly, but something he wrote elsewhere leads me to think that they're not as far apart as they seem.
Doesn't it also refer to Neshama as being a higher level than Nefesh?
The Kabbalah, correct. The birth terms are reversed.
And that's why I said you probably have heard that the Neshama is higher than Nefesh, but that element of the Kabbalah has become common speech. The Rambam takes it in the opposite way.
Now, there is a statement in the Talmud like this. Resurrection, which the Rambam does believe in, is necessary for a last judgment for the following reason. The Talmud gives a parable. There was a man who owned an orchard, and he saw that fruit from the orchard was being stolen. He did an investigation, and his suspicions landed on two people, and he accused them of the crime, stealing from the orchard. The two people said, "You're making a mistake. Look more carefully. You'll see that we couldn't have stolen the fruit. One of us is crippled. Take care. He can't walk. The other is blind. He can't see. Clearly, we did not steal the fruit." The owner of the orchard said, "You can't fool me. I know what you did. The blind one picked up the crippled one's shoulder. and the crippled one who could see told the blind one where to walk. And that's how you stole the fruit. Now say Chazal, if God will want to judge the soul or the body separately, each one will have a perfect excuse. God will say to the soul, why did you rebel against me? The soul will say, God, you know that I love the true, the beautiful, the right, the holy. I rebelled against you? Surely that wasn't I. God will say to the body, why did you rebel against me? The body will say, God, you know that I have no power of decision. I can't make decisions. So I'm just a machine. Surely I didn't rebel against you. So God says, so to speak, you can't fool me. I understand. It's the two of you together. The soul and the body together. That's what committed the crimes. And therefore, for a final judgment, you must have resurrection, because it's only fair to judge the agent that performed the action. And since the soul didn't perform the actions, and the body didn't perform the actions, you cannot judge the soul or the body. You have to judge the soul-body combination. That is as far as the statement Chazal goes, and the Rambam agrees with that, and that's why he provides for a resurrection. But now, you could, with logic, extend a corollary from that statement. What about the reward? Shouldn't the reward apply to the agent who performed the action? Should you cut out half and give the reward only to half? Doesn't seem to be appropriate. So if you're telling me there has to be a resurrection, the soul must be together with the body in order to be judged, then also, for the sake of the reward, the soul should be together with the body. What the Rambam pictures is resurrection, judgment, and then the body disappears. And the soul all goes into the world to come. It seems that from the logic of the Chazal, if you apply your own understanding to it, you should derive the conclusion that the reward also has to be for the agents that perform the actions, and that's the way it's written in the Kabbalistic work, that the soul and the body have to go in together. I, the Rambam, quoted the Chazal. In the world to come, there's no eating, and there's no drinking, no sitting and no standing. Doesn't that mean that there's no body? So the Agrama, who represents the other point of view, I think the Agrama was a Makubal, whether he was a Kabbalist, he just opposed Rambam on this. He said you could read that Chazal in the opposite way. Why are you telling me there's no eating and there's no drinking and there's no sitting and there's no standing if there's no body? If there's no body, then of course there's none of those things. So on the contrary, what Chazal is telling us is something more subtle. That these aspects of body there are not. But other aspects of body there may be. So instead of taking this as a kind of broad template that there's no body at all, it's taken more specifically as saying that these aspects not, but other aspects yes. Now, the Kabbalistic works picture the following. Let's start at the beginning. There's only one God, right? There's only one God. And He created everything. And He is spiritual. So everything has its root in the spiritual. There can't be two objects, two entities, two dimensions that are really opposed to one another. Really opposed. Because if they're really opposed, they have to come from two different sources. And there's only one God. The minute you start talking about two really opposed entities or dimensions, then you're flirting with polytheism. The body also has its root in the spiritual. It cannot be otherwise. Now, the job of the soul is to spiritualize the body. The body is created in a certain condition, but it has the ability to grow and develop in another condition. Here's the analogy that the sources use to explain it. Imagine a spark of fire that is enclosed in a shell. Think of the spark of fire as the soul, and the shell as the body. Now, the body encloses the spark of fire, so the light cannot escape. How can we enable the light of the soul to escape, and also external light to be communicated to the soul? There are two ways. One way is to annihilate the shell, obliterate the shell, then nothing stands in the way of the light. The other way is to make the shell transparent. Instead of being opaque, make it transparent. Religions divide on this. Religions divide on this. If the body is enclosing the soul and preventing the light from going in and out, how do you overcome the body? And there are religions that say that in order to overcome it, the body has to disappear. The other way is to make it transparent. Those of you who know a little science, take a piece of glass. Glass doesn't just let the light through. The light interacts with the glass. That's why eyeglasses work. If all the glass did was let the light through, it wouldn't focus the lens, focus the rays. And your vision wouldn't be any better with the glass without the glass. No, photons interact with the molecules in the glass and come out different. That's why the speed of light in glass is not the same as the speed of light in a vacuum. Light goes more slowly in glass than it does in a vacuum. So the glass becomes the ally of the light. Not only doesn't it stand in the way, but it participates in the transmission of the light. This is the analogy to the ultimate relationship of the soul to the body to the soul. The body no longer encloses, no longer opposes. The body becomes an ally of the soul in spreading its light and receiving light from God from the outside. That body, that transformed body, is eternal, and it goes into the world to come with the soul, and enjoys together with the soul whatever there is to be enjoyed in the world to come. So, indeed, there's no eating, there's no drinking, there's no standing, there's no sitting. That's correct, because the body in its present form isn't there. But that doesn't mean the body is simply annihilated. No, it's transformed into a different state, and in that different state, it becomes an ally of the soul. Here's a little hint of how it works. This is from the Ramchal and the Das Tunos. Did you ever think, as the Ramchal, life means the soul and the body are connected? What we call death is when the soul leaves the body. Now, you stay alive by eating. How does the body, eating a hamburger, keep the soul connected? What does one thing have to do with the other? Animals eat food also. They don't have any souls. Isn't the human body essentially an animal body? So how can ingesting food, physical food, keep the soul connected to the body? Yeah. Okay. Good. That is a way to answer it. The Ramchal doesn't take that way to answer it. Frankly, I don't know why he doesn't use that answer. That answer is based on the Kabbalah also. But listen to the Ramchal's answer. Ramchal's answer is that.
Well, why would you?
Huh?
Why would you say?
If what?
The reason we eat. Could be a spiritual reason.
Before you get to why, you have to understand how. This is a mistake to make in biology and evolution. They always want to know why, and the foggiest idea how it works. But they already figured out why it developed that way. You know how it works. Francis Crick said that's the short sightedness of evolutionists. Alright, but let me tell you what their own concept is. Constance, we have a principle that a guest has to operate according to the rules of the host. A guest must operate according to the rules of the host. Now, this world is a physical world. If the soul is going to interact with this world, it has to play according to the physical rules. It's subject to the rules of this world. So, since physical bodies stay alive by eating, the soul's connection to the body is preserved by the physical body eating. Now, what happened to Moses on Mount Sinai? Moses was on Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights. Didn't eat and he didn't drink. Now let me ask you a silly question. Do you think he lost weight? The world's most successful crash diet. No eating and drinking for 40 days. Came down like a scarecrow? Probably not, right? So, but then how? How could it be that Moses didn't eat or drink for 40 days and nights? And he didn't lose any weight. Because, says the Ramchal, in that world, the body was the guest. The soul was the host and the body was the guest. So the body has to play according to the rules of the soul. And the soul wants absorbing Torah, which is the nourishment for the soul, and therefore the body's state was preserved. Okay? Now, there are five levels. Those are levels 5 and 4, going up. Our world, where the soul is a guest. Mount Sinai, where the body's a guest. But the body needs nourishment. It just gets a different nourishment. It needs it. The body is subject to the sun and the cold, and but it's protected by, in a different way. Now, as you go up to higher levels, the body loses more and more of its overt physical function, and becomes more and more an aspect of the soul, an aspect of the soul's capabilities, but something which the soul uses, something which doesn't stand in opposition to the soul, to the point where the body, in the end, becomes a potentiality of the soul to operate in physical fashion, but no more than that. And that potentiality is now fully an expression of the spirituality of the soul. That's roughly the picture that you get in the Dasunas, yeah.
Doesn't the soul need the body, sort of speak, to get to the next level?
That's not my subject at the moment. Now, that's the picture in the Kabbalah. The body doesn't disappear, it's not annihilated, it's absorbed into the soul, transformed, and always continues to exist. By the way, says the Ramchal, other Kabbalists, this applies to the world also. The world as a whole becomes transformed, and continues to exist in that transformed state. This is ultimate conservation. Nothing gets lost. Everything that was created is preserved, but in a different state. When you look at that, and I saw this many years ago, it looks like the Rambam is on one side, and the Kabbalah is on the other side, and there's no connection whatsoever. They're worlds apart. But in the Rambam's introduction to the Pirkei Avos, what's called the Shemona Torah, first parak, the end, the Rambam describes the activities of the soul. What does the soul do? And he applies it to certain things that the body has to express. For example, he says, we know human being as a body and a soul. How do we think of the roles of the two of them? In particular, how do we think about growth? Body growth. So the trees grow. So the flowers grow. The body sees. So cows see. The body feels. So the cows feel. The body can smell. So can cows smell. The body ingests, excretes, reproduces. Animal bodies do all that. So how do we look at it? Do we say, this body is an animal body? Okay, it's differently shaped, differently formed, it's different abilities, but it's an animal body. And in addition to the animal body, which grows like a plant, and moves and perceives like an animal, in addition it has a soul. And that soul is for spiritual things, heavenly things. And the two of them are working together. That's one way to look at it. You can already guess that's not the way the Rambam looks at it. The Rambam says no. The soul directs every activity of the body. Growth. There's no parallel. whatsoever between growth in a human being and growth in a plant. Growth in a plant is a purely physical principle. Growth in a human being is an activity of the soul, directing the body how to operate. Seeing in a cow, seeing is a matter of eyes and brain. And that's all. That's all it needs. That's all it's got. Human being, seeing is a matter of what this soul does. Motion. An animal's motion is produced by its brain. Human being's motion is produced by its soul. I'm not going to give the famous analogy. If you are standing a mile away and you see, at that distance, a human being and a monkey, you might not be able to tell clearly the difference between them. When you get closer up, you'll see there's a vast difference between them. Similarly, if you look superficially at a human being and a monkey, and you see they both grow, and you see they both move, and you see that they both hear and taste and smell and see and act, you could think that the principles governing their activities are the same, but not true. If you look more closely, you'll see that the human being, all of what happens in the human being, even the vegetative and animal functions, are under the control of the soul. Okay? That's his position. Now, that means, if I think of the soul, in my mind, it's true, the soul has a section which is aimed at the body, aimed in detail at the body. This part of the soul controls growth. That part of the soul controls perception. That part of the soul controls motion. Everything the body does is a matter of how the soul affects it, how the soul directs it and operates with it. Okay, now imagine cutting out the body. You eliminate the body. But those elements in the soul aren't eliminated. The soul remains intact. The soul remains complete. So internal to the soul, you have a bodily focus. It's just that there's no body there to be focused on. There's nothing there to catch the focus. But internal to the soul is a bodily control element. Well, how distant is that from the Kabbalistic idea that the body is refined and transformed into something which is just a capacity of the soul? It seems to me that the end picture is very similar. Not true, as some people objected to me when I presented this idea, the process by which you get to the end picture isn't the same. In the Rambam's picture, the body's just lost. It means God created things and then just discarded them. In the Kabbalistic picture, nothing is discarded. Everything is created for a purpose, and everything ultimately will fulfill that purpose. That's true. But the end picture, I think, is not so drastically different between the two of them. At any rate, I would say that the bald position, that the body disappears, has been, so to speak, outvoted by history. And I think that in our times, one could not take that position. But that is what the Rambam says here. Yeah, you with me so far? Now, another thing. What is it that creates the connection to the world to come, through which a person deserves the world to come? His knowledge of God. His knowledge of God. That's all that counts. What about the mitzvot that you do? The Rambam says the mitzvot are there to enable a person to achieve that knowledge. Even love of God. Love of God is an expression of that knowledge. But the medium of connection is that knowledge. Now, I want to offer you another speculation based on some sources, which may help a little bit. Imagine the Messiah comes. And the Navi says, Malakum Ha'aretz Be'ez Hashem. The whole earth will be filled with the knowledge of God. The miracles at that time will far outshine the miracles of the Exodus from Egypt. The whole world will know the Torah is true, that we represent God. the whole world will become our willing servants. Will there be free will at that time? Will people be making decisions between good and evil? Will rebellion against God be an option? Sounds very difficult to imagine. Sounds very difficult to imagine. The Ramban says explicitly, Yomim Asher Eini Chepetz Behem, days in which there's no Chepetz. Chepetz means desire. The world will be so filled with God's knowledge, it will be like automatic. There's a certain stage where that happens. The Ramban might not be the immediate coming of the Mashiach, sometime later. What will people be doing then? What's the purpose of their living at that time? Now, let's put together another fact. You've heard of resurrection, right? The resurrection of the dead. Does that happen all at the same time? Does that happen all at the same time? So there are different views. Some Rishonim say that it's a long process. It's a gradual process. People will be revived from the dead over time. Some first, some later, at different times. Why would that be? What's the point of that? That means some people will go through Tchiyat HaMetim and live 50 years, 100 years, 200 years in this body, in this world, before the ultimate transition to Olam HaBa. What is that for? Now, you could answer as follows. Let's imagine a person who lived his life as a great son. He did what God wanted through sacrifice and courage and pain. And because he lived in a difficult historical period or in difficult personal circumstances, never achieved this knowledge of God, which is the key to entry into the world to come. Not through any fault of his, but because war was going on, because famine was going on, because sickness was going on, and he just couldn't achieve it. Where is the fairness that this person served God faithfully all his life with great courage and self-sacrifice and never achieved this knowledge with which you must get into all the world to come? You can't get in without it. It's a necessary condition to get in. So, here's a way that you could fill that gap. Allow such a person to be resurrected early in that period, and give him the time to live to achieve that knowledge, not through his own decisions, not through making decisions between good and evil. There's no temptation at that time. But in this world, he's put through the process of acquiring that knowledge, so that when the world comes, that knowledge can be his key to living there. If you put the ideas together that way, you can explain how the knowledge can be a key to the world to come, and yet a person can achieve it if he deserves it, even though in this life, in our world before the Messiah comes, it wasn't made possible for him to achieve it. And anyway, so I'm trying to understand, explain the Rambam. So far as I know, the Rambam does not have the principle of guilt. Right. The Rambam does not have that principle. That is a principle, again, which comes from the Kabbalah. And those who did not have Kabbalah typically did not accept that idea. In fact, I don't think the Rambam even discusses it. Sadiq Alam discusses it and rejects it. I don't think the Rambam even discusses it. I don't know any place where he discusses it. That's just not part of his constellation of ideas.
A small question. When name is given to the person, is it the property of the soul or mm-hmm. the combination of soul and body? And can the same soul later on have different names under the Jewish model?
As far as I understand, it would be the soul and the body together. Okay. Now, let me ask you a trick question, which many of the commentators ask. Let's suppose a person, one of the sons, has performed a transgression whose punishment is curse. Curse means his soul is going to be cut off. He's not going to live in the world to come. Now, as you know, as we said, if he does tshuva, then the crime is wiped out. And he will live in the world to come. Only if he doesn't do tshuva. But, huh?
Before or after death?
Tshuva is only before death. Tshuva has to be before death. But he's decided not to do tshuva. He's given up. Okay. He's given up, he's not going to do the tshuva. Does he have any reason not to do it again? Or not to do another crime whose punishment is cursed? After all, he's already lost the world to come. Can't lose it twice. It's over, it's over. He may know. Why not? Why not?
How did you know at what point that's it, so you don't get Olam Haba?
He committed murder. Murder is a transgression for which there's curse. And he knows he committed it, and he says, well, but that guy was so bad, I'm not sorry. I'm glad I killed him, and if it means I don't get the world to come, I don't care. I'm just happy that I got rid of him. Alright? And then he thinks to himself, I'm not going to do tshuva for this. I'm happy I did it. I don't regret it. I'm not going to regret it. So why shouldn't I kill other people or do other things that have courage? Because once you've lost, it's lost. You can't lose it twice. What incentive is there for him to minimize his failures if he's already done a transgression that will cause him to be lost in the world to come? Without tshuva, actually in the Rambam, without tshuva, you can't fix it. If the resurrection was said, not, you don't have any free will. You don't have any free will, you certainly can't fix it. Say again?
Can one still get kares nowadays?
What about that? Sure, kares is a spiritual punishment. Nothing to do with courts, nothing to do with testimony or anything else. It's for a deliberate transgression of certain types of. Tarot
means
turn
off the moral back.
That's right.
Course, but you can't get punishment.
So now, there are two answers to this question. One answer is that courage is a double effect. One is the person's cut off from the world to come, and the other is he's cut off early from this world. That's one answer. So then another transgression will mean to lose more life in this world. And the other answer that's given is that in addition to being ultimately cut off, there could be an interim punishment. An interim punishment. In other words, you could go to Gehenna, suffer in Gehenna, and then be lost. So the double jeopardy. To say to him, listen, okay, you made your peace with not having the world to come, fine, but I want you to know that this additional transgression is going to cost you 6 months in Gehenna. That could stop. That could be an incentive not to. So the idea of being cut off can be supported, and you can still explain why it would be a wrong, would be in your own self-interest, not appropriate to do it again. Yeah.
When you're in
Kares?
Yeah. Is it you're never going to go to the world to come, or are you going to soul gets like exercise to go to the world?
So the Rambam's position, this is the last one I'm going to make, I hope. The Rambam's position is the soul is annihilated. It's annihilated. It ceases to exist. That's the great punishment, he said, for the wicked, for the Hashoim. That's the great revenge against them, is that they cease to exist.
Wouldn't the worst punishment be that they go back into this world?
Wow. Then you have an opportunity to earn everlasting life. Why would that be a worse one? I would think anybody had a choice of losing forever or trying again would want to try again.
Yeah, but like, I mean, when you come back into this world, it's a rock has a soul, and they have the intentions of wanting to kill.
Fine. You know, it's like surgery. Nobody wants to do surgery, but if it's a suspect of surgery or death, people take surgery.
As painful as it is. I learned once that one of the punishments is that you go back into this world, but it's okay if it's a murder, that's considered a thing, but he can make it. The actual being inside
the
rock is considered the fixing of what he did.
Yeah.
An act of
the
but the wrong
usually, Gilgal is only for a tikkun, it's the fix.
That's true, but he still has like
That's why he suffers. That's why he suffers. That's why he suffers. I'm talking to Rambam, for whom Gilgul is not an option, right? It's not.
Yeah.
That's not. Yeah. I don't think it's right to say that he loves, well, loves unconditionally. Let's not think of reward of curse. Let's just think of reward and punishment. Now, is reward and punishment an expression of unconditional love? Then how could he punish?
Unconditional.
Well, just one, but now that when we had the destruction of the temple and exile, he didn't give him another chance. He said, listen, I gave you enough chances, and here I'm giving you the punishment. And you can't, and you're going to receive the punishment.
Gives you a chance.
Okay, okay, okay. Now, with courage, you have your whole life to do tshuva. He gives you chance after chance after chance. Every day, every new day of life, after the person has performed that crime, every new day of life is another chance to rectify.
You get a short life, you don't know how long it's going to take.
But there's not as if he doesn't have chances, right? Maybe he was going to live 80 years, and he performed a transgression when he's 40.
Yeah.
There's only 70 years. It's 30 years to the truth. So it's not as if he's not given more chances. He's given more chances to the point where, indeed, now I must tell you, this is another case where Rambam took a position, others disagreed. Here the Rambam is not isolated. There are others who took the position that a soul can be lost. But how, interestingly, as in some of his writings on both sides of the issue, and I've asked people how that could be, and I've not gotten a good explanation. The Ramban, Nachmanides says, a soul could never be destroyed. Such an idea is inconceivable.
Any soul.
He says even more than that. He says, we know that in the physical world, nothing ceases to exist, it's just transformed. Transformed into other forms. Say, in the physical world, things don't cease to exist. All the more so in the spiritual world. And he explains, the statements of Chazal would seem to say the opposite. He explained them all, but they're all different. So, now, let me just finish by answering what comes out of this question. How could it be that God who loves us, I won't put in unconditional, but God who loves and God who creates the world out of loving kindness could tolerate the annihilation of a soul? Where would the loving kindness be in that? But here is an explanation. Anything you receive is better if you earned it. There are some people who, by nature, are thin. They can eat anything and everything. Doesn't matter. They're thin. Then there are the rest of us, who, in order to stay thin, have to be very careful about what we eat. Who will have more satisfaction and more pride from being thin? The one to whom it comes naturally and eats anything and eats everything and stays thin, or the one who takes care and creates his own thinness? Obviously, the second one is going to have more satisfaction from it, more pride from it, more sense of his own accomplishment from it. Anything that you accomplish, you earn on your own. It's something that you have more satisfaction from. Now, that's why we're in this world before we go into the world to come, so that the reward is reward. It's not just a gift. The big difference between a gift and a reward. Reward is something you earn. Gift is something you didn't earn.
So we're in this world, so what we get in the world to come is a reward. And we should be able to see in the world to come, I'm getting X, Y, Z because I did A, B, C. Those things that I did mean that's why I'm getting these things. So that in the world to come, like Ramchal says in a number of places, a person will be matzik a lot of din, and he will be able to say, everything was done rightly, I can see that everything I got came from what I did. Now let's ask, how about your mere existence in the world to come? Just being there. Let alone the particular place you have or the particular things that you enjoy. Just being there rather than not being there. Can you say, I earned that? What would it mean to say, I earned it? Let's say, listen, I am here. I'm here because I did Q. That's why I'm here. Because I did Q. Now that's true. It must mean that somebody else who didn't do Q wouldn't be there. It means being there can't be guaranteed. Because if being there were guaranteed, then nothing I do produces it. So in order for those who aren't there to have the extra benefit that their being there is something they earned, it has to be possible for someone to lose it. Otherwise you couldn't earn it. That being the case, the loving kindness to all those who will earn it has a price. And the price is that those few who don't earn it don't get it. Otherwise, all those who do go won't have that benefit of having earned it. So it's a playoff. It's a playoff. And if you understand, as Ramchal understands, that the number of people who are lost is minuscule, then you could understand that the playoff is worth it. Everyone's given the opportunity to earn it. The vast majority will earn it, and they will have the extra satisfaction of having earned it. Those few who push themselves into a totally black corner, those few are going to be lost, and that's the price of enabling everyone else to earn. Right. That's a big one way to analyze. Yeah.
And so the size of those few, everybody else, I guess, resurrected at the end of the day, that we get them.
Okay, here the point, the matter becomes detailed and tricky. Some make it to resurrection, some will make it to resurrection and then be annihilated. Doesn't mean that the annihilation takes place beforehand, and the final judgment after the resurrection. There, I don't know anybody who has all the details laid out clearly, and of course, it's controversial, different people have different sheets, but at the point of the end state, whether you're there or not, is the difference. Okay.
I have a problem with Kohen, and he said that the drive for him to stay good is that he can might go to Gehinnom or might lose several years of his life.
Right.
But if he's Rasha and doesn't believe it,
I agree with you. Now, we're talking now about someone who does believe. People who came on him, Mama Yemala, who Avad Olamala. I agree with you. I'm not talking about a person who doesn't believe. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a person who does believe. And even if he does believe, what is going to stop him?
So
I'm answering for a person who does believe. If a person doesn't believe, of course not. But such a person,
it's like him doing good.
Okay, but such a person who doesn't believe is like a person who will drink. He's like a person who will drink milk that is almost stuck, unpasteurized milk. So he's going to get sick, right? Yeah. He doesn't believe it. That's too bad. Rachamim alav, right? Rachamim alav. They're pity for such a person. His ignorance is going to cost him. It's going to hurt him, right? But we're talking about a person who does know. Even a person who does know, what incentive does he have? That's the answer.
Okay, we shall have.
Yeah. Okay.
No, this is not the number of minutes.
No,
it's too late.
כן, בדיוק כמו חזקיהו המלך, שחזקיהו בא אליו ואומר לו, אתה נאבד, אתה מות, אני קיבלתי מן דבר המלך, שאף פעם אדם לא ימנע את עצמו מהרחמים, והוא הסיר את הפנים שלו לקיר, מתפלל, חי עוד כמה שנים.
No. My number?